state in collecting the costs of the ambulance services provided in case there is some challenge to them in the collection. And what Senate File 217 does is it would provide the same treatment for ambulance services that are private and licensed by the state. So they then would also be able to present their claims to the state, and the state would then collect all such claims, whether they be from a private ambulance provider or a state or a publicly funded ambulance provider.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I do have present with me O.J. Doyle from the Minnesota Ambulance Association, and he can answer questions here, and he may have just a bit of an introduction to this bill as well.
Thank you, Senator Ortman. Mr. Doyle, do you have a comment you'd like to make?
Yes, briefly, if I might. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is O.J. Doyle. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. Ambulance services, public and the private, have been under the revenue recapture law as a claimant agency for approximately 8 years, 9 years. And what has happened is when the law was drafted, the government-based services filed their claims directly with the state, and the not-for-profit or the private ambulance services filed the claims through the county, who then passed them on to the state. And it ended up being kind of a bureaucratic nightmare. What's happened is the Department of Revenue now is doing all of the claims. There are no counties involved whatsoever. And so all we wanted to do when we approached Senator Ortman is just clean up the law to reflect what is really going on right now.
Thank you, Mr. Doyle. Questions, members? We do have a quorum present now. Senator Ortman, you have an A1 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I do. The A1 amendment I would offer as an author's amendment at this time. It's just a clarification, making consistent both sections of the law. The original bill was drafted to the first section of Minnesota Chapter 270.03, Subdivision 2. And then what the A1 amendment does is add on and make consistent the changes through Section 2 of that same section of the statute.
Thank you, Senator Ortman. Any members, any questions? Senator Ortman offers the A1 as an author's amendment. Any objections? The A1 amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I think we have to have a vote. I made that same mistake my first day.
So. All right. All those in favor of the A1 amendment being adopted, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? A1 is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move that Senate File 217 be recommended to pass and move to the Senate floor.
Senator Ortman moves Senate File 217 to be recommended to pass. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Senate File 217 is passed.
Members, thank you for your support and for your flexibility this morning. We are now going to hear Senate File 28, Senator Rust's bill on abolishing levy limits, and Mr. Carlson is here to testify in support of that bill. It's an interesting topic this year. It's been around for a while, and I believe that someone from the department is here to talk about the history. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Ms. Zoff is going to talk about the history on the status of the levy limit law. So if you don't mind, Senator Rust, we'd like to begin with that so people are brought up to speed, especially our new members.
That's fine. I was going to do it myself, but certainly Ms. Zoff is welcome to do it as well.
And okay. Ms. Senator, if you have additional comments afterwards, you'll be welcome to make them. Ms. Zoff.
Madam Chair, members, the current levy limit law that's addressed in Senator Rust's bill was enacted in 2008 as a part of the omnibus tax bill. And that particular version of the levy limit law was made to be in effect for 3 years. So it was for taxable 2009 through 2011. So taxes paid in 2011 will be the last set of property taxes that are subject to levy limits under this version of the law. Levy limits first came into play in 1972 and were in effect for 20 years. And that original law was part of the 1971 property tax reform that was part of the Minnesota Miracle. And they've been in effect off and on since that time, and they've had various formats, but essentially they have acted to limit the levy of local government institutions. It's not the tax rate that's subject to the levy, but the actual amount of the levy. Under the current law, the levy limit law applies to cities in excess of 2,500 population and to counties. The smaller cities and special taxing districts are not subject to this levy limit law. The levy limit base is determined for the current levy year by looking at the previous year's levy limit base. And then you also take into account the impact of certain aids that are paid to the local government for cities. It's LGA. For counties, it's the county program aid, and also taconite aids. So that if those aids are reduced in a given year, then the levy limit base is adjusted upward to accommodate that. So the levy could be adjusted if the aids are reduced. Currently, then, there are some adjustments to the levy limit base. You start with the last year's levy, and then you would increase it by the lesser of 3.9% or the implicit price deflator, and that was currently 1.6784%. So we didn't hit that 3.9% adjustment. There are also adjustments for half of the percentage increase in the number of households and also half of the percentage increase in the taxable market value that's due to new construction of commercial or industrial property. I think that's kind of the basics. If you have any questions, I can help.
Ms. Zoff, would you just comment on the types of things that are outside the levy limits?
Sure.
Because there are a significant list of exceptions to the rule on levy limits, certain types of expenditures from our cities and counties that operate outside the levy limits.
Madam Chair, that's correct. There are a number of categories of expenditures or costs to the local government that are referred to as special levies, and those particular types of expenditures are not subject to the levy limitation. Some of the more significant exceptions or levy limits are debt service levies, amounts that are levied for state and federal required matching grants, amounts that are needed for preparation for and recovery from natural disasters, some abatements, increases in public employee retirement association rates after 2001, jail operation costs, the operation of lake improvement districts, repayment of state or federal loans related to highways or capital projects, and for an animal humane society. So you can see that some of these special levies are in categories that are costs that are difficult for the local units to control, so, you know, the natural disasters, things that they are legally bound to pay, such as the debt service in particular is important there. And then the lake improvement districts and animal humane societies, it's not uncommon for advocates for a particular cause to come before the tax committee and say, you know, these are some expenditures that are really important that might get squeezed if they can't be levied outside of the levy limits. So things become special levies for a variety of purposes.
Ms. Zoff, if you would, in 2009, we adopted levy limits under Governor Pawlenty's budget, but we added exceptions again, and I'll talk about them. I have them from House Research. I'll list them, and Ms. Zoff, if I miss one or I'm incorrect in speaking, please correct me. But we added five new ones. Exceptions to levy limits include increased costs related to reductions in federal Health and Human Service program grants, to cover city costs in cities with high foreclosure rates,
for Minneapolis to cover unreimbursed costs related to the I-35W bridge collapse, for salaries and benefits for police, fire, and sheriff personnel, and to recoup any LGA or county program aid losses. And that was if the governor unallots them. So it's pretty hard in my mind to find a very consistent policy of levy limits. But with that introduction, Senator Rust, welcome to the committee. I hope you'll introduce your bill. Yeah,
thank you, Madam Chair. I would just point out one additional thing, that the levy limit base that was adjusted in 2009-2011 did have stricter limits, and Ms. Zoff pointed out what those three were, but they were stricter than has been before. And if members are interested in the research draft that Ms. Dalton did in House Research that the chair was referring to, I can provide you copies of it. It's actually a very interesting history of a tax policy that has gone back and forth between having no levy limits, having levy limits, and then the occasional proposals to have a property tax freeze, and there is such a bill now going around. And even with that, it is a it's interesting where people talk about, well, we need to freeze property taxes, and when you ask them a hard freeze or a soft freeze, we end up with, well, we'll freeze them, but then, Madam Chair, as you pointed out, they start listing a bunch of exceptions to that, including, in particular, debt service. But we have gone through major discussions about levy limits and proxy tax freezes, and as a matter of fact, in 1996, the Senate had a very strong position for a property tax freeze, and we did end up with a bill that year. The House was opposed to it, that bill that year, but it did not include a property tax freeze, and it was one of those instances where only agreed-upon items from the conference committee, which did not include that provision, were passed by both the House and the Senate. Senate File 28, Madam Chair, is a bill that would not only allow the sunset to occur for levy limits, but would abolish them permanently. I hope members do have the revenue estimate from the department, which shows that there's really no general fund impact. In the bill, you'll notice, and I'll just go through it, and then I have an author's amendment, Madam Chair. In section,
Senator Rust, if you would just hold 1 minute. I'm not sure we all have the revenue estimate. We don't have the revenue estimate, Senator Rust. But you have one?
I can give it to a page. It's zero.
Maybe we can get some copies of this.
It's all neutral. Ms. Zoff, do you have it?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was online. Section 1, dealing with a notice of proposed property taxes, eliminates a cross-reference to voter-approved levies under the general levy limit law. And a lot of the sections in the bill, you'd think that it could be very short, but there are parts of the statutes that refer to levy limits, and when we're going, the proposal to abolish them needs to address every section in the statutes where they come up and either eliminate them or change the cross-reference or do something like that. So a lot of it is fairly technical. In Section 2, that's an elimination of a cross-reference there. In Section 3, there is this is what's going to be amended. It removes a current requirement that local governments report the amount levied for each special levy purpose allowed under the general levy limit law. And the department and others Council, thank Mr. Paulson for that, indicated that those reports really do perform a valuable service to the department and to our nonpartisan staff as they are giving us up-to-date information about the impacts of various property taxes. And so the author's amendment makes sure and clarifies that the that those reports would continue. Section 4 changes a citation that's used for a cross-reference to the state and local government implicit price deflator, which Ms. Off indicated was is the inflation indicator that had been used for 2009 through 2011 levy limits. And in Section 5, it changes the citation that's used for, again, a cross-reference to the state and local government, again, implicit price deflator in the Met Council levy.
Senator Rust, excuse me. Would you like to offer the A1 so we can pass it out?
No, I'd like to finish my summary first.
All right.
Section 6 changes the citation that's used for a cross-reference to the state and local government implicit price deflator again. And then Section 7 repeals those sections of the law that deal with levy limits and beginning with taxes payable in 2012. Now, Madam Chair, with your permission, I would offer the A1 amendment.
Members, the A1 amendment is being handed out. Senator Rust, would you like to explain what the A1 amendment does?
As I mentioned in going through the summary, in that section of the bill, the department and our researchers were concerned that we needed to make sure that the reports that are currently being filed with regard to the levies from local governments continue to be filed and not just a single number of this is what we levied, but what the levies were for, and the special purposes, because that does make a difference when we are looking at the vagaries of property tax policy. And this amendment that was prepared for me by Mr. Paulson makes sure that that reporting requirement stays in place so that it can be helpful.
Senator Rust, did you refer to the vagaries in property tax law? It's that's pretty vague. Senator Rust,
it's not a disease, Madam Chair.
It's close. Senator Rust offers the A1 amendment. Any questions or comments from senators? All those in favor of the A1 amendment, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. The A1 is adopted. Senator Rust, would you comment on the revenue estimate, which has been passed out? And in particular, will you talk about the sunsets? We're going to sunset automatically for 2012. This, so your bill really would just make that effective that sunset effective earlier. Is that right?
The law that's in effect only goes through payable 2011. It just seemed to me that it could give comfort to local governments in particular if we asserted a permanent policy of abolishing levy limits. Now, doing that, of course, doesn't bind any future legislature, and they could come back and reimpose them. But it seemed to me that it was a good statement for this legislature to make and this tax committee. And the bill, it has also been introduced in the House to say that we're going away from that policy. It's a failed policy. It has not necessarily, or in very few instances, and Mr. Carlson can speak to that, limited levies. What it has done is, in many instances, been a stimulus to levies. Once people and local governments know what the levy limit is, they levy to the limit, whether they, quote, meet it or not. And we have seen instances of that. and it is a, you know, it's a false sense of savings, I think, for the taxpayers to have local governments be so afraid of what the legislature is going to do to them next, that they go ahead and take the chance and take the risk and quote levy to the limit rather than through a perhaps a more careful budgeting process. And when we haven't had levy limits, there's been no particular indication that levies just skyrocketed. When Ms. Zoff pointed out in the history of levy limits, starting in 1972, what seems to have happened is that we reimpose them every time we make a major change or because we get afraid of local governments. So when we do property tax reform, we got to put levy limits back on. When we do do things with state aid, we have to put levy limits back on. And I think that we have very mature local governments that we can trust to make those kinds of decisions, and levy limits is a false promise to taxpayers, and is quite frankly just not necessary.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rest, I've been here long enough to have voted both ways on levy limits over the years. But I've noticed that despite the fact that we have levy limits currently, our property taxes keep going up. Now, there's a lot of factors involved in formulating property taxes, but am I being counterintuitive if we take off limits? My natural thought is we take a limit off something and taxes will go up even further during a time when our property values are real market values. The real world selling price of selling homes is going down. So why would we do this?
Senator,
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, I go back to the chair's testimony. Levy limits are, in a sense, a false promise. Every time we have imposed them, we have, or thought we were doing that, we have listed exception after exception after exception. These things, this whole list of things, is outside of levy limits. There were so many of them at one time. They were, listed alphabetically, A through Z. And then it was more than 26. They had to go back, and we started with double A, double B, double C. Levy limits were a nice, phrase, but they really had no impact anyway. And so if we're looking for transparency and honesty in what our tax policy is, then we really don't need the false promise of something like levy limits. And I think you'll hear from Mr. Carlson's testimony that the cities, and he's obviously most familiar with cities, and I think that's where we hear mostly about levy limits, that they've been quite responsible and don't need this false promise of levy limits to act in a fiscally responsive as well as responsible manner.
Thank you. Mr. Carlson, welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. Thank you for having me today. And I want to thank for offering Senate File 28, a bill that would repeal levy limits or abolish levy limits in their entirety. We think that it would allow cities to set their budgets and their property tax levies according to local needs and based on local desires of their citizens. I should indicate that Patricia Nauman from Metro Cities also indicated to me that they do support this legislation as well, and so rather than duplicate our testimony, I'll just put on the record that they do support this this bill as well. Let me add two things to the history of levy limits that I think might be helpful for you. One is that when they were first enacted back in 1972, that was at the time when we were creating the Minnesota Miracle and many of those aid and credit programs that did help cities and counties fund their services. At that time, levy limits were actually used as a way to make sure that some of the aid that was given to cities and counties was actually translated into tax relief. So the way the levy limit works, as Ms. Zoff indicated, the levy limits are computed based not just on the previous year levy, but the previous year levy plus aid. And as aids went up, levy authority effectively went down. In latter years, we've used levy limits in different respects. Senator Rest indicated that we have used them during times of major property tax reform. And most recently, we've used levy limits as a way to control levy increases at a time when we're actually cutting aids. So if you look at the history of levy limits, they've been used during aid increases, reform, and aid decreases most recently. One other thing that I should indicate for you, and this is not related to levy limits directly, but in 1988, we did create a new state law called the Truth in Taxation Process. And part of the reason for doing that was to make sure taxpayers understood what was going on, what was being discussed at the local level in terms of budgets. And every year, we send out a notice to taxpayers telling them what our plans are for the upcoming year. And that process, I think you should keep in mind, does do a very good job of educating the taxpayers and using them effectively as a control over the local budget decisions of city councils and county boards. So keep in mind that we do have a process in place. It's rather unique to Minnesota local governments, not directly related to levy limits, but certainly the intent is to make sure taxpayers are aware of the decisions of city councils and county boards. Let me just mention a few things related to unintended consequences of levy limits. We already indicated that, Senator Rest indicated that in some cases, cities will levy to the limit because they don't know what the legislature might do in a subsequent year. Let me say that the levy limit law, and you all that have been here for a while, Senator Limmer, Senator Rest, you've constructed that law such that you do not effectively penalize a frugal city or a frugal county. Your levy limit is based not on what you levied in the previous year, but what your levy limit was in the previous year. And that has been a way to make sure that we're not incenting or we're trying to create a neutral incentive through the levy limit law. That said, in 2003, we did enact very, very tight levy limits that only allowed cities and counties to recover basically two-thirds of their aid loss during that tough recession. And that did create a new concern by a lot of our cities and counties, and it has created somewhat of a guessing game as to what might happen in subsequent years. But there are a few other quick practical considerations. We hear frequently, and we did in 2008 when levy limits blinked back on, that some cities had been very, very frugal. They said they held their levies down, and now you're going to blink levy limits on at a time when they had been frugal for the last couple of years. And they felt as if they were being penalized for being frugal in the years prior to levy limits. I think you should keep that in mind as you think about levy limits in the future. And then finally, one additional concern that I hear very frequently in talking with city officials. During years of levy limits, it can actually act as an incentive to borrow because borrowing or debt service is outside of limits as a special levy. And in many cases, our small communities would prefer not to borrow. They would prefer just to spend cash or raise cash and buy that squad car or that ambulance rather than issuing debt certificates. And it may actually encourage the use of debt and the additional cost of paying for that debt service for that purchase. Finally, I just would like to tell you that, and this is to Senator Limmer's point, that this last year we did enact a few extra special levies, in particular related to aid losses. Now, the levy limit formula, as Ms. Zoff indicated and as I indicated, does account for changes in aid payments to cities and counties. However, the way the aid reductions were enacted back in 2008 under the unallotments, in 2009 under the ratified unallotments, and in 2010 under the ratified unallotments in the supplemental budget bill were done after the fact, and cities basically had no authority under the levy limit law to levy for those aid losses. That's why those special levies were added. But that said, Just on the city side of the equation, cities lost $180 million of aid payments last year, aid and credit payments, during the 2010 calendar year. In 2011, the first year they could levy for that loss, levies for cities collectively across the state went up by $39 million. So we lost $180 million, levies only went up by $39 million. That's not because of levy limits. They could have levied for all of that $180 million. They chose not to. I think that indicates that our cities are very in touch with their taxpayers, the economic circumstances. They're making difficult decisions that are, in fact, resulting in budget reductions. But I think just this last year gives you an indication that levy limits really don't have an impact. There really are a rather failed policy. Madam Chair, I'll stand for questions.
Mr. Carlson, can you comment on the transparency issue? From in my mind, if you're a taxpayer and your city is following the levy limits, they aren't necessarily following the levy limits because you might not understand about the special levies that appear separately. And so what you might think is a city following a levy limit could be something entirely different and could be raising spending quite significantly in one of those exceptions. Can you comment on that a little?
Madam Chair, in 2008, when levy limits were reenacted, beginning for April 2009, I know there was a lot of press coverage that the levy limit was effectively a 3.9% cap. That is only a very small part of the overall calculation of the levy limit. We did see that in some cases taxes went up by more than 3.9% because of special levies for debt services or lost aids. So it can create a misunderstanding among taxpayers because of, we have these carved out exemptions that can have an impact on the overall levy increase. The other problem, to be very honest, is because of the way the property tax system works, if a homeowner's value rises much more quickly than other homeowners, they may see a bigger than a 3.9% increase in their bill simply because of shifting taxes, nothing to do with the levy limit law, and that can further confuse taxpayers as to why they're not seeing an exact 3.9% levy increase.
Senator Limmer.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't think we have to worry about people's property values going up these days. Matter of fact, they're going down. In the last few years, just in my own house, it went down 25% in market value, but my taxes went up 50%. And I just don't see any sense in taking levy limits off. Historically, I remember the Ventura days when we imposed some large reforms. We cut property taxes on average by 18%, but you wouldn't know that now. And then Chairman Abrams, the tax committee chair, warned against political subdivisions not having a limit on levies. And everyone promised him, from all of the representatives of political subdivisions, oh, that isn't going to happen. But it did, to the point that the legislature had to blink on levy limits. So what kind of guarantee can we get from the proposers of this that levies aren't going to go up? I don't see the logic here.
Senator Rest?
Well, Senator Limmer, Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, you've raised a couple of points. Mr. Carlson talked about the when values go up, et cetera, and you said, well, that's not happening anymore. However, the property values going down are also not uniform. So your house might have lost 20% of value. Somebody else's house might have lost 25% of value. So, I mean, it's just a flip-flop. So I don't think that that's a particularly strong argument. But where, in just in terms of why you had a property tax increase, it might not have been at all because there was any additional spending done by the city of Maple Grove. It might not have been that at all. Just the mix of all the elements that go into what the rate is going to be against your particular kind of property and how the assessor has valued it. Some people's homes might have seen a decrease in the same year that yours saw an increase. That doesn't have anything to do with levy limits. Levy limits, again, are a very false promise to taxpayers. Mr. Carlson pointed out that last year they lost $180 million. They could have levied $180 million. We allowed that, but they didn't need that. And they levied back only $39 million. I don't have the same recollection of the time when that you were recalling where spending just went out of control in local governments because they didn't have levy limits. I don't recall that. That's not my recollection of that period of our tax history at all. And I quite frankly don't understand the suspicion of local government officials in being able to run their cities in a responsible manner. I once made some comments on the floor of the House when I served there that on this same issue, quite frankly, that when your voters go to the ballot and they vote for you at the top of the ballot and you think they're pretty smart for voting for you, they don't all of a sudden get stupid when they start voting for their city council members in wanting people to be fiscally responsible with the dollars that they pay for government services. And I think that legislators, and I, for myself, I take that for myself as well, we need to remember that that lesson over and over again. Local governments should be in a partnership with the state government as we depend upon them at the state to deliver the services that we all value as communities and as community members, and we should have a level of trust that they are going to do that once again in a responsible manner. And levy limits is a, you know, in my mind, is a patronizing attack on our partners that is has never really been necessary and certainly is not necessary at this any longer at this time.
Senator Howell.
Madam Chair, I've got a couple of questions. It appears that, you know, the fiscal note, the levy limits are set to sunset anyhow, correct? So there's no change between current law. If they weren't set to sunset, would there be a cost? Would there not be a cost?
Senator Howell, Ms. Zoff should probably answer that question.
Madam Chair, Senator Howell, typically I believe the Revenue Department would estimate that there might be a change in the behavior of the local governments, that they might increase their levies. And when that occurs, there's an interaction, increased circuit breaker costs and that sort of thing that becomes a state cost to the extent that they make the assumption that the local governments would increase their levies.
So there could be a cost if the sunset provision wasn't in there, correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, if the sunset provision were not in current law and there was the assumption that the levy limits would remain in effect but for this bill, then there would probably be an estimate of a cost related to the interactions with the circuit breaker.
Okay.
Senator Howe?
Madam Chair, and, you know, I would agree that you're going to have elected officials that, you know, if they raise the levy limits too high, that they're probably not going to get reelected. They're probably going to do what
they raise the levy to.
Right, if they raise the levy, I should say. But I guess my other question is why wouldn't we just let it sunset versus abolishing it? And does this also abolish the levy limits for the Met Council? And my point being is, at the local, the county, and the city level, you've got elected officials, and at the Met Council, you have appointed officials. So I'd just like to.
Good questions.
And I see there's a change to the Met Council in line 6.10, and I'm just wondering what that does in that change there, or how it's.
Why don't we begin with Ms. Zoff? She has an answer on two of those three questions. Ms. Zoff.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, the Metropolitan Council is not subject, no special taxing districts are subject to the levy limit, the general levy limits that are the subject of Senator Rest's bill. But within the Metropolitan Council, law, which is not addressed in this bill. There are provisions that enable the council to make levies, and those are subject to internal limitations within that law. This bill does not affect those, the Met Council levies. The provision that you're looking at on line 610, the reference to the Met Council on line 6-7, there's no change there. The only thing that's being changed in this section is a change in the reference or the source of the definition of implicit price deflator. Under current law, this refers to the definition of implicit price deflator that's in the levy limit laws that are being repealed in Senator Rest Bill. So this provision would change that reference to the implicit price deflator law that is referred to in the state general levy law. So it's just a change in the source of that definition. It shouldn't affect the Met Council levy.
Yeah. Madam Chair and Senator Howe,
Senator Rest.
As I mentioned, going through it, it's a lot of pages here, but a lot of the cross-outs or changes are just technical references to make sure that it could happen. But this does not apply at all to the Metropolitan Council's levies, and I agree with you completely that we have a different level of accountability from people who are or should have for people who are not elected and never stand to for the voters' decisions on their or never stand for election on based on the voters' decisions. And with regard to the sunset, if there wasn't the sunset already in place, there would be. I agree that there would be this circuit breaker cost. We don't know what that would be. It was probably part of the in 2008, part of the revenue estimate at that time. I would still argue that keeping it, I mean, it's not going to add anything, but making it a permanent public policy is a good thing for the legislature to do, the sunset notwithstanding. And I think it, in particular, it could perhaps ward off those who want to undo the sunset. And I know that you have a lot of experience with doing local budgets and from your previous experience in city government, and probably understand better than any of us here what the impact of that has been on budget-making responsibilities.
Are there others here that would like to testify in support or in opposition of Senator Rest's bill? The other, Mr. Carlson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Inter-County Association. On behalf of the other level of local government subject to levy limits, I too want to endorse Senator Rest's bill. I would like to make several comments as to why this bill is appropriate. First, as a representative of the level of local government that had the lowest annual levy increase based on the preliminary levies this year, 1.65, I would just point out that really levy limits for the last 3 years have not had much effect. I have not seen the finals for this year, but for the past 2 years, almost without exception for counties, they have been below their levy limits. They're subject to the same political and fiscal considerations as you are and have constrained their levy increases and have not needed this program to put an artificial restraint on them. There are a couple, I think, misconceptions that have already been addressed, but I want to do that once again. Levy limits simply are not successful in keeping tax increases from occurring on any one property. The dynamics of the property tax system as values shift between one property and another will result in the issues that Senator Limmer addressed, regardless if you have levy limits or not. The levy limit is simply not successful in meeting those types of situations. The state's targeting program, however, is one way to respond to that issue. I do want to again emphasize the perverse implications that exist under current levy limits. Despite the fact that the current program does not have this element to it, the myth continues to perpetuate itself among local officials that you have to keep your base up in order for you to respond appropriately when the state imposes levy limits once again. So consequently, to combat that, what currently is a myth, repealing levy limits is one of the best way to get rid of that myth. And reality is that there is an incentive, if you are running up against your limits, to incur debt rather than to pay as you go for certain capital expenditures, and that's a perverse incentive. It's also, frankly, used by local officials to avoid accountability and transparency for their own decisions. You will frequently have individuals appear in front of interests appear in front of a local council or a local board and receive a response from the board or the city council, "Well, we'd like to do this, but levy limits prevent us from providing the funding for this." This is a shield that, frankly, needs to be gotten rid of. This is, from local government's perspective, one of the mandates that we would largely like to get rid of. With that, I'll conclude my testimony. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bill Barnhart. I'm representing the North Metro Mayors Association. It has dawned on me, this is my seventh year representing the group, and I was involved with that group probably for another 15 years beyond that. I think the most consistent legislative policy the group has had has been opposition to levy limits. Thank you for bringing this forward. Two reasons: the local control issue, but also it does create confusion because of shifting property values or because of what is allowed to be done. And trying to explain to a property tax owner, "Well, your house went down, but it didn't go down as much as somebody else," is very confusing. But then also trying to explain the exceptions in the law dealing with debt, dealing with public safety, dealing with, you know, at that point in time, the property tax payer just glazes over. But you said 3.9. No, the law was constructed. So for those two reasons, we have been always opposed to the imposition of levy limits.
Thank you. Members, Senator Limmer.
Thank you. On that last comment, you talked about this adds to the confusion concept. If this concept was put into law, does that get rid of the confusion when property values go down and taxes continue to go up?
Mr. Barnhart.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer. There might be ways that you could eliminate, quote, the confusion to keep it within the overall limit. At that point in time, you now have very much inserted the state into the local decision-making process.
Mr. Barnhart, can I ask a question about the property tax statement? The special levies, or maybe Mr. Carlson can help too, but the special levies are separate on the property tax statement, so if you're trying to track your elected official, they are not. So are they disclosed in the truth and taxation
they may
statement?
Or may, Madam Chair, they may or may not be.
So then if they're being reported to the property taxpayers, they're seeing the entire amount, and the local elected officials or administrators can say they're meeting the levy limit requirements, but they're actually levying outside the levy requirements for any of these exceptions that we already talked about. That's the concern I had about the transparency. What do the taxpayers know about these exceptions when they're given their property tax statement is my question. How would they hold their local elected official accountable to the 3.9% levy or levy limit? Senator Rust, maybe you want to comment on that?
Madam Chair, I think that's an excellent question. I'm trying to think of what's actually on my property tax statement. I know that we have voter-approved levies, and they're stated separately. And I know that the special assessments, which are different from, you can't count that as part of your property tax deduction, for example, they're stated separately. If your property is within a tax increment financing district, that whole amount is stated separately, and you don't see really the city's amount at all. But I don't think that we have a requirement for a line that says this amount was levied within, quote, levy limits, and this amount is levied outside levy limits. And maybe Ms. Zoff or Mr. Paulson knows differently, or somebody else, Senator Pogermiller maybe, or Senator Skoy. But I don't. I think there's just one number.
That's my understanding, Senator Esp, but yeah. Mr. Carlson, do you have an answer on that?
Madam Chair, that's essentially correct. There's no specific disclosure on the tax statement or in the formal process for informing the taxpayer. Levy limits are
through truth in taxation.
Right.
Levy limits are really an issue between the city and the county and the state to which they report their levies as part of the state's regulation of the process. As Senator Ress indicated, our responsibility to the taxpayer is covered by the meetings at which the council adopts its levy and adopts its budget, and by the truth in taxation notice, which discloses to the taxpayer the full effect of the decisions that are being made by the council or the board before the council or board acts to adopt its final levies and budgets. The property tax statement, quite frankly, is reach probably its capacity in terms of the amount of information that can be conveyed in a one-page document. So I would personally be reluctant to see additional information added to it. But I think the existing truth in taxation process more than adequately handles that issue right now.
Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, I just want to speak to the transparency issue because I'm just wondering how you get the taxpaying public to actually see exactly what the local government officials are doing. And I'm just wondering when a local government body does like a preliminary levy limit, if there might be some requirements on what they have to include in that, because you've got people that, there's some communities that are pay-as-you-go, and there's other that like to borrow and do bonding. And then you have these comparisons of per capita spending, and you've got the ones that have debt service and have bonded, and you have the other ones that are pay-as-you-go, and those numbers look out of whack, but then you when you dig a little deeper into the details, the people that have the higher per capita spending may be the more fiscally responsible entity than the other one. And I'm just wondering what the and maybe just discuss a little bit about the preliminary levy limits that they go through and that they set there, and as if there's something that we could include in there, because I think the transparency issue is the key. I don't think it's the levy limits. It's how they're spending their money or whether they're going into debt to do certain projects, whether it's capital expenditures or what have you. So just some thoughts on that.
Senator Rest.
Again, Senator Howe, I think, raises some really interesting points, and cities do differ in how in responses to their constituents on how they're going to go about providing for the services. I know in my own city, New Hope, that a number of years ago, the city council, when the street improvement program was coming to an end of a cycle, decided that they were no longer going to special assess for it. They were going to put it, all of us were going to pay, and then it was just going to go back through the street improvement cycle. And there There was a lot of discussion. I don't think there's anybody that doesn't know they don't have special assessments anymore. It's all in the property. It's all in the property tax, and we like it because it is available to be deducted on our income taxes. It's a property tax deduction, whereas the special assessment could go on for years, and some people improperly include that amount, which they should not, because you can't deduct on your income taxes a benefit to your property in particular. You can't do that. But when it was applied across all properties, it was controversial at the time, but we certainly all knew about it, and that was a decision that was made and then reinforced by supported ultimately by the citizens of my city. Now, and there's still a lot of cities that don't do that. New Hope was able to do that because it wasn't going to give a double whammy. Special assess a whole group of properties and then come back and then just do a general property tax. They were able to do it at the end of a street improvement cycle. So cities aren't all apples to apples, depending on what their needs are and where they're situated, and the transparency is certainly not achieved by levy limits, but once again, I think is a responsibility of local officials. And I know that when we have the truth in taxation hearings, if people are generally happy with what's going on, they don't show up. But when a city council or a county board gets out of line, you know, you can get 100 people. I mean, I'm talking about like New Hope, you know, like 25,000 people. You can get 100 people to come to a truth in taxation hearing. Or Hennepin County would get hundreds in past years. And now I doubt they get a dozen people. Truth in taxation, some people consider that an invisible check. But when a local government, goes wacko on some sort of tax policy, people don't put up with it, and they show up. And changes happen. We saw that in Minneapolis this past year. People did show up in Minneapolis, and the mayor and the city council did change their levy.
Senator,
I think
Leonard,
that part of the system is working very well, but levy limits as a state tax policy didn't have anything to do with it.
Members, I think we could debate all day about whether we agree that levy limits are a good idea to keep property taxes low or not, but I'm hoping there's some agreement that it's questionable as to how meaningful they are when you have this many exceptions. And I think that's one of the points of Senator Rust's bill.
Absolutely.
Is that there? It's questionable in terms of its effectiveness if the cities and counties can then levy outside of the levy limits for all these different things. Senator Howe.
Madam Chair and Senator Rust, I agree, and especially when you get into the special assessments. I think levy limits maybe give a false sense of hope or a false sense of security to taxpayers. That would be just my comment.
Thank you. Other comments from members? Questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Sundjum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to go all the way back to the beginning of the discussion, just to get grounded a little bit, I think you, and I'm just talking about when this all blinks off. And my understanding was that you said that it would blink off with levies payable in 2011. If I understood you correctly, and I'm thinking that those levies were established in December of 2010, so I'm not connecting somehow to. Is this bill about the levies that would be voted on by city councils in December of 2011? That's my question.
Senator Rest.
Yes.
Ms. Zoff, is that your understanding?
Madam Chair, Senator Rest and Senator Senjum, this bill doesn't really change the, if there were no other changes to the levy limit laws to extend them this year, there will be no levy limits in effect for Pay 12. This law also affects Pay 12. The real effect of this bill is just to remove the levy limit provisions from the statutes. You know, if the legislature doesn't do anything to extend the application of levy limits this year, they will no longer be in effect for Pay 12 going forward. This bill does not affect the timing of that at all. It just removes the language from the statute.
So they wouldn't have them.
Senator Rest.
But it's a permanent policy by removing the language.
Right. Senator Pogue-Miller. Ms. Zoff, do you want to just clarify further?
Madam Chair, the effect of this bill would be to remove the provisions of the levy limits from the statutes. There had been a practice, I think even going back to the last time they blinked off, of just leaving the language in the law. And so that when the legislature chose to reinstate levy limits, it could just change the effective dates and make them effective again without reenacting the text. This would remove the text of the language from the law. And if I could add, there should be one technical correction in two places on page 6, lines 10 and 26. It refers to subdivision 2, and that should be subdivision 1.
Senator Rest.
I move to amend the bill as described by Ms. Off with that technical correction.
Thank you. Ms. Off, would you just repeat it once more for the record, please?
Madam Chair, members, the amendment would be on page 6, lines 10 and 26. 2, following subdivision, should be stricken and insert 1. So it refers to subdivision 1.
So moved by Senator Rest. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair.
Senator Senjum.
Again, just so that maybe I understand, levy limits are going to click off anyway. What this is all about is really removing reference to levy limits in the statutes. So, I mean, that's meaningful, I suppose, but... You know, really, insofar as levy limits are concerned, they're going away anyway, and this is just housekeeping.
Senator Rest.
Madam Chair, Senator Senjum, I agree with you. What it's doing is making that a permanent policy and endorsing the legislation that we did in 2008 and just getting it off the table. It's not really a huge change in policy, but it is, I think, still remains worth a worthwhile discussion about where they came from and how they're used, how they're sometimes abused. And it is a positive thing to do that. But you're quite correct.
Well, and Senator Rest, this Senate, the 2011 Senate, does not yet have a position on levy limits one way or another. Whether you agree with Senator Limmer that they're a good idea to put some limits on local governments or not, if you think you support local control, we don't have a position. And so it does make some sense not to have all this language in our statutes. We haven't negotiated that. It might become a point of negotiation or it might not, but it doesn't make sense to have all this excessive language since we don't have a position going forward.
Thank you for making that argument for me. Yes.
I agree. Rest. Well, the chair would like to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill without objection. Senator Howe, did you? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say no.
No.
The Senate file 228 is laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much, Madam.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Members, we're going to get back to the conversation we had last week on the governor's tax provisions in his proposal, and Assistant Commissioner Mossman has agreed to join us again
at his own peril, knowing that we really like to talk about this stuff in this committee. So, Commissioner Mossman, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. We left off, my recollection or understanding is that we have a few remaining provisions to get through so that we've walked through the entire budget. My recollection is that we left off on page 35 of the budget document, if members have that. And with me, Madam Chair, is McCall Garber and Pat Finnegan, two attorneys with our Legal Services Division, just if there are any questions on these somewhat more technical provisions, so we make sure we can answer your questions. To start with the proposal on page 35, just in the way of background, the remaining provisions here are really provisions that arose out of the department from a transparency efficiency standpoint. They weren't really so much driven by the budget dynamics itself and the putting together of a balanced budget proposal. So with that background, the first recommendation here of the governor's on page 35 is to make some adjustments in the cigarette and tobacco license fees to bring the tobacco license fee for tobacco distributors to the same level as the cigarette distributors fee of $300 every 2 years, and also to make some adjustment in the subjobber license fees up to $75 per year. One of the issues here, somewhat at the department level, is the concern that with increasing compliance issues related to the selling of unstamped cigarettes and being able to access unstamped cigarettes sold in other states, that the fee, the thinking is that the fee being set somewhat higher for the tobacco licensing fee would help to address that issue.
Mr. Mossman, so if I went into my local gas station to buy a pack of cigarettes, which I wouldn't do, but if I were going to do that, he has to pay more to buy the cigarettes to put them at the gas station. Is that the type of tax we're talking about, or am I misunderstanding?
Madam Chair, I don't believe it would be. I don't believe it would be the retailer. It would be the distributor. So the person who is getting a license to purchase the tobacco products wholesale would be paying this fee, not the retailer.
Well, Mr. Mossman, he'd pay it to the state, right? Or excuse me, yeah, he would pay it to the state, or would he pass it along to the retailer?
Madam Chair and members, you're correct. This additional $150 over the course of 2 years would presumably somehow be factored in by the distributor in their relationship with the retailer. It's a fairly nominal amount. I wouldn't necessarily expect the price of cigarettes or tobacco products to change as a result of this license fee change.
Mr. Finnegan, did you have another point on that or further clarification?
Madam Chair,
I'm sorry. Can you introduce yourself for the record,
yes,
too, sir? I'm sorry.
My name is Pat Finnegan. I'm an attorney with the Revenue Department. I think Mr. Mossman correctly stated that these fees are at the wholesale level, and they're fairly nominal. The distributor license fee would be $300 for 2 years, and the subjobber would be $150. We're talking roughly about 100 cigarette related licenses and close to 200 tobacco product distributor and subjobber licenses. So it's not a big factor. It wouldn't be a factor, I don't believe, as far as the price of cigarettes at the retail level.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, if there are no additional questions, then on page 36, there is a proposal that the governor recommends repealing a statutory tax credit against the excise tax that's granted for unpaid debts that are owed to the distributors. This is when it's a bad debt under the Internal Revenue Code. Just to be clear here, bad debts as a cost of doing business from the business would still get the income tax benefit from that. There's no change here. What this would change is that there would no longer be a credit for unpaid debt against the excise tax. Currently, under Minnesota law, if there's a bad debt scenario between a distributor and a retailer, the state is essentially picking up the cost of that bad debt in the fact that the distributor is allowed to get a credit against the excise tax paid for that bad debt once it's been identified and meets the definition of a bad debt under the Internal Revenue Code requirements.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair.
Senator Marty, and then Senator Hall.
Madam Chair, Mr. Mossman, how did this come into being in the first place, this credit for bad debt?
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I don't know for sure, but I believe it was something that the industry lobbied for. You know, there is some similar bad debt provisions in the liquor tax law and the sales tax law.
Thank you, Mr. Finnegan. Going on, Mr. Mossman.
I was just going to make a comment,
Senator
Chair.
Howell,
I was just going to say it looks like the that they're going to go to maybe a COD operation on this cash on delivery, the wholesalers. But it appears that the cigarettes are smoked, the tobacco is chewed. It's just that the taxes aren't collected because someone didn't pay for it. Correct,
Mr. Mossman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Howell, that is correct.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, then on page 37, moving on to just a couple provisions here related to insurance tax and collections. Under current law, the first provision here relating to the taxation of policies sold, surplus line policies. Under current law, there's a difference in the gross premiums tax rate that's assessed depending upon whether or not the insurance is purchased directly from the insurer versus whether or not it's purchased from the agent. If it's purchased through an agent, it has a premiums tax of 3%. If it's purchased directly from an insurer, it has a 2% tax. And the proposal here is simply to equalize them and have them both be a 3% tax.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Mossman. Have you gotten any opinion from, let's say, insurance agents versus the distributor? Is it distributor of insurance? Whether they agree with this policy or not? What does the industry think about this?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I have not yet. I will be, again, you know, this is not. The proposal here was an effort to have transparency and consistency regardless of how the policies were purchased. I have not heard from the insurance company. I will certainly make an effort to make sure that we get any concerns from them as to whether or not they.
Madam Chair, Mr. Mossman, let me just ask a question so I understand this. What's referred to as non-admitted insurance, is that insurance that's purchased? I'm using your reference here. Is that insurance that's purchased through an agent versus the straight from an insurance company? Explain the relationship.
Sure.
Again.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, not admitted insurance refers to a type of insurance, and I might be, Ms. Garber might be able to expand on that, but The issue here is that you can purchase non-admitted insurance from either an agent or directly from the provider of the insurance. But the tax is different depending upon whether you purchase it from an agent or directly from the insurer. The insurance coverage could be exactly the same in both cases. It's just the venue in which you purchase it from that is the platform for there being a difference in the tax rate.
And Madam Chair, was it cheaper for the insurance agent to offer the insurance than the company, or is there a marketing advantage for one group versus another?
Ms. Garber?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I am not aware, but Ms. Garber may have more familiarity with how the industry works in that regard.
Welcome to the committee. Will you introduce yourself, Ms. Garber, please?
Madam Chair, my name is Michal Garber. I'm with the Department of Revenue. Non-admitted insurance, as Mr. Mosman said, includes insurance that's purchased directly from an insurer and includes also insurance that is purchased through a licensee, a surplus lines licensee. And currently, the licensee pays a higher rate than if the insured buys it directly. So I would assume that they would be happy to equalize it, because right now it seems it would be more beneficial for an insured to go directly to an insurer rather than go through a licensee.
Mr. Mosman, don't these provisions just make the price of insurance go up for Minnesota purchasers?
Madam Chair, the recommendation here is really based on fairness with regard to your question. It would make the impact you're referring to only for situations where the insurance is being purchased through one venue, an agent, from an insurer, whereas other taxpayers who might be purchasing this insurance through an agent are already paying the tax at the 3% level. So the intent here is to equalize it among consumers and the sellers of insurance, and not to disadvantage one or the other.
Thank you. Mr. Mosman, the taxes on bottles and taxes on wine and spirits.
Madam Chair and members, the provision on page 39 is another recommendation here that arose out of conversations in the department included in the governor's budget recommendations, because it has some budgetary impact, is to simplify the taxation here for wine and spirits. But there's a bottle tax that's been in place of a penny a bottle that has been in place since 1986. My understanding is that this tax came on in relationship to liquor stamping requirement that we no longer have. This would repeal the bottle tax and attempt to make a revenue neutral proposal by adjusting the excise tax by the same penny in an effort to have a largely revenue neutral proposal, but in the process eliminate the bottle tax.
And Mr. Mosman, the car rental tax increase.
Madam Chair and members, there are a few proposals that are included in the budget document here for informational purposes. They arose as well out of discussions and proposals that are shown elsewhere in the budget as well, related to some other agency proposals. The governor recommends increasing the car rental tax by 1%. Related to an effort to provide some additional resources to Minnesota tourism to do some additional promotion of Minnesota tourist opportunities. That is what is summarized on page 40 and included here with the tax recommendations for informational purposes. Obviously, it is a change in a state tax.
Mr. Mosman, would they be dedicated funds?
Madam Chair and members, the intent is certainly to be able to have the additional resources available for tourism. I am not exactly sure this isn't if the language will actually have this kind of fenced off for the, I'm not exactly sure the answer to your question yet, whether or not it will be fenced off, or if the intent is to just increase appropriations for Minnesota tourism in this regard. But the intent certainly is to have the resources, the additional resources in the general fund in order to support tourism promotion.
Thank you. Mr. Mossman, we have quite a bit more to go, and I know you're, you know, I think we're at least generally familiar with what happened with the local aids and credits, but if you could break into that tax changes from other budget areas, if you could just briefly outline what that is. I'm looking at page 4, members, of the summary.
Madam Chair and members, I actually don't think we have too far to go. Most of the remainder, beyond these informational pieces that we're now talking about, the entire remainder, remaining pages of the budget document are the background pages that describe for you the local aid and credit programs. So all of page 44 through the end of the document are simply background pages that describe these programs for you as part of the budget book. The governor makes no recommendations for changes in funding levels or allocations of any of the property tax relief or local aid programs. So there are no changes in the remaining pages.
But Mr. Mossman, on page 4 of the budget handout from February 15, I'm looking at the major categories of expenditure and revenue types. The last category is tax changes from other budget areas. Can you explain what that line is in this summary?
Sure.
What
page, Madam Chair and members?
Page 4.
On page 4, Madam Chair and members, at the bottom, there's a line second from the bottom in that chart that says tax changes from other budget areas. Madam Chair, those are the changes that were for informational purposes, that one of which we were just going over. So one of those is the 1% rental car tax is included in that line. And then in addition to that, Madam Chair, there's a proposal to eliminate the direct grants from the medical education and research cost account. That's page 42 is the detail on that, and the governor has a recommendation to extend the petroleum fund sunset date and continue collecting the petroleum fee. That is on page 43 for informational purposes of the budget document, provides additional detail. So those three provisions make up that line there.
And then, Mr. Mossman, that line also refers to that same group of other tax areas on page 5. Is that right? So that general line on page 4 refers to...
Madam Chair and members, that is correct. It's the same as the line on page 5 under the other taxes area section, the bottom item there, informational tax items carried in other budget areas.
All right, thank you. Members, questions for Mr. Mossman about the governor's budget? All right, members.
Madam Chair.
Senator Senjum.
Not specifically and not for today, but maybe on another occasion. I didn't want to bog down Senator Rest's bill, but there is this thing that we hear and debate frequently around here that if you reduce aids and credits to local governments, that in effect, two-thirds of that will be levied back locally per some revenue department reference. And then today, Mr. Carlson from the League of Cities mentioned that, I think he said that, and I'm not sure if it was last year or whatever, but $180 million had been cut, aids and credit, and only $39 million, or a third, basically, had been levied back. So the question is really, again, for another day, when we do this, do we have any idea really what this number is, factually, based on experience? Is it one-third levied back locally, or is it two-thirds, as the debate would suggest that we have?
Mr. Mossman.
And we don't have to answer it today. Maybe another day, but if you wanted today, that's fine.
Well, I think it's a great question and maybe a study that would make some sense. I mean, I don't mean an intensive study, but maybe just a little bit of the history on that, Mr. Mossman, if you could help us with that.
Madam Chair and Senator Senjum, I'm going to kind of understand your question in two parts. The first part, the two-thirds assumption, there's actually a long history of a working group circumstance with both legislative staff and Department of Revenue staff that reviews the response of local governments to changes in state support for local programs and state aid programs in terms of what then ultimately happens in terms of how local services are funded. And that approach is routinely reviewed and updated, and the most recent assumption has been the two-thirds assumption that has been the working assumption in terms of how much changes in local governments will result in increases in property tax. So that's been the working basis right now, is the two-thirds assumption. Potentially that will change. I know you heard testimony this morning, so potentially that may change, but that's the working assumption that I think everyone would be using right now, both on the legislative staff and Department of Revenue staff. Beyond that, I think in terms of all local governments have the opportunity to respond differently. And the governor's proposal, the intent really behind the governor's proposal is that by not making changes at the state level, that kind of reinforces that if there are changes at the local level, that those will more clearly reflect the choices that local governments will be making in terms of from a jurisdiction to jurisdiction basis in the levy decisions they have to make without the change in tax aids and credits funding levels being something that provides additional pressure on their budgets to make changes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Skoy and then Senator Palmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Senjum, you know, I've thought about the same question that you just asked, and I think it depends on what kind of time frame you're looking over, because cities have abilities within their budgeting to delay or shift just like we do. If you're going to assume that the cities are going to maintain the same level of services over time, aid cutbacks will be 100% levied back. But if you assume that they're going to do some shifting or some delaying, then there gets to be a smaller number of levy back. But if they're going to, over time, maintain the same services that they currently were doing prior to the aid cut, it would have to be 100% because, you know, it's the only place that they can get the revenue to offset that.
Senator Pogamiller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mossman, as I've understood that number, that's based on kind of historical what has happened. How often does that's correct, right? How often does that get updated? When do we retake the snapshot and say, here's now what our best historical evidence is?
Mr. Mossman.
Madam Chair, Senator Pogamiller, I believe that it's yearly. I would have to check, but I believe that every legislative session staff gets together and reviews that.
Mr. Mossman, Mr. Ouellette is right behind you, and he's nodding, so that's pretty good affirmation of what you just said. Members, tomorrow we will have a tax expenditure study, the update, based on the legislation we passed last year. We have two bills from Senator Reinert and one bill from Senator Nenow. We will hear testimony on the governor's proposal on Thursday. And to that end, Mr. Mossman, people are asking for a bill. When are we going to see a bill, and have you identified authors?
Madam Chair, the bill, there is language that is still being drafted, and it has not been entirely vetted at this point as well with the governor's office. So I don't have an exact timeline for you in terms of when we will have language, but it is something that we're diligently working on.
Well, Mr. Mossman, what we do here is we hear bills. That's what we do in the legislature. So I would encourage you and the governor to prepare a bill so we can look at it and work on it.
Madam Chair, I will take that message back.
Thank you. The hearing is adjourned.